In the popular mind, human nature is perceived in terms of common needs, no longer in terms of a dignity shared by all, in spite of distinctions in status. In this context, a triple heart bypass is not seen as a foolish and wanton desire, nor as a demand which only the rich can claim, but as a need which translates into a right which, today, calls for an entitlement. For people generally, needs acquire their absolute legitimacy, paradoxically, when one is certain that they must be attributed to strangers, especially in those circumstances under which it is obvious to common sense that, for the majority of the needy, such needs cannot be met. Ironically, when human nature is socially defined by a bundle of needs basic to all, then a kind of scientific proof appears that for most members of the human family, what is basic is definitively beyond reach. To see how we reach this impasse, which now gives way to a systems analysis model, it is instructive to trace the stages through which the notion of needs was related to economic and social development in the last few decades. The idea of development entered Western political discourse through the inaugural address of Harry Truman in 1949. Truman sounded altogether credible when he advocated the need to intervene in foreign nations with industrial progress in order to raise the standard of living in the underdeveloped areas. He didn't mention revolution. His aim was to lighten the burden of the poor, and this could be accomplished by producing, quote, more food, more clothing, more materials for housing, and more mechanical power, unquote. He and his advisers saw, quote, greater production as the key to prosperity and peace, unquote. He spoke in terms of legitimate aspirations, not about needs. When Truman spoke, poverty, in terms of a market economy, was still the common lot of the overwhelming majority in the world. Surprisingly, a few nations appeared to have overcome this fate, thereby stimulating the desire in others to do the same. Truman's common sense led him to believe that a universal law of progress was applicable, not only to isolated individuals or groups, but also to humanity at large, through national economies. Thus, he used the term underdeveloped for collective social entities and spoke of the need to create an economic base capable of meeting the expectations which the modern world has aroused in people all over the planet. 12 years later, Americans heard that, quote, people in huts and in villages of half the globe struggle to break the bonds of mass misery. We pledge to help them to help themselves. We pledge this not because we seek their votes, but because it is the right thing, unquote. Thus spoke John F. Kennedy in his inaugural address in 1961. The statement symbolized an emerging consensus in the U.S. that most people are needy, these needs give them rights, these rights translate into entitlements for care, and therefore impose duties on the rich and powerful. According to Kennedy, these needs are not just economic in nature. The poor nations, quote, have recognized the need for an intensive program for self-help, a need for social progress, which is an indispensable condition for growth, not a substitute for economic development. Without social development, the great majority of the people remain in poverty, while the privileged few reap the benefits of rising abundance. Unquote. 1 year after Castro's rise to power, Kennedy promised more than economic or technical help. He solemnly pledged political intervention, help in a peaceful revolution of hope. Further, he went on to adopt fully the reigning conventional rhetoric of political economy. He had to agree with Khrushchev, who told him in Vienna, quote, the continuing revolutionary process in various countries is the status quo, and anyone who tries to halt that process not only is altering the status quo, but is an aggressor, unquote. So Kennedy then stressed the shocking and urgent conditions and the need for an alliance for social progress. For Truman, it was the modern world which arouses new aspirations, and he focused on the need to lighten the burden of their poverty. Kennedy believed that half the world lives in bonds of misery, with a sense of injustice, which breeds political and social unrest. In the perspective of the 1960s White House, poverty ceased to be fate. It had become an operational concept, the result of unjust social and economic conditions, lack of modern education, prevalence of inadequate and backward technology. Poverty was now viewed as a plague, something amenable to therapy, a problem to be solved. In 1962, the United Nations recognized poverty as a definable threshold, somehow related to what is human. The Secretary General referred to, quote, those people who live below an acceptable minimum standard, unquote. And this standard soon revealed its complex nature. It acted just like an iatrogenic disease, that is, a disease made by doctors, spreading mayhem throughout the world. The sad results of policies conceived as therapies for this conceptualization of underdevelopment. Then, in 1972, the president of the World Bank declared progress that is measured by a single measuring rod, the GNP, has contributed significantly to exacerbate the inequalities of income distribution. And for this reason, McNamara declared that the central objective of development policies should be the attack on absolute poverty, which had spread as a result of economic growth, and which was so extreme that it degrades the life of individuals below minimal norms of human decency. Soon these norms of human decency would be spelled out in dollars and cents by a team of social scientists who formed a kind of brain trust within McNamara's office. The confusion and, at times, opposition between economic and social development, observable in McNamara's thinking, between mere growth and true or human development, became a part of public rhetoric, of what I have termed the development discourse. Through efforts of experts to understand and establish the distinction, the term needs first acquired its vexing power, still current today. Using this term, the humanistic political theory of development sought anchorage within some ontological concept of human nature. In appearing to be empirically relevant today, this search worked its way through a new, a historical, notion of poverty. Until a few decades ago, poverty had been a synonym for the human condition. It was understood as a pervasive feature in the social landscape of every culture. Primarily, and above all, it referred to precarious conditions within which most people survived most of the time. Poverty was a general concept for a specific cultural interpretation of the necessity to live within very narrow limits, defined differently for each place and time. Each culture worked out its unique and ecologically sustainable style of coping with this necessity, as we can recognize today. This is what need formally signified: the lifelong ability to face the ultimately unavoidable. We all need to die, however, not yet. Until recently, then, poverty never directly meant a lack. The necessity to accept fate, kismet, providence, the will of God, lost much of its legitimacy during the early 20th century. Progress reveals its face when it is understood basically as a revolt against necessity. And that's where we're going to have to leave Illich this episode. There's another 25 minutes which, if you like, you can download from this show's website, unwelcomeguest.net/45. 554, but now it's time for a radio adaptation of a film by Gene Brockhoff. This is Shop Till You Drop, subtitled The Crisis of Consumerism.
The world we move through now bears few traces of our industrial past. Everywhere we look, we see signs of modern capitalism's most enduring legacy, an immense accumulation of commodities and objects and manufactured desires. Things and messages marketing things now saturating every part of our culture and shaping virtually every aspect of our everyday lives, so that in many ways, we're no longer defined by the work that we do, but by the objects we consume. Industrial society has morphed into the consumer society.
When Spending Becomes You, as read by Juliet Shaw, a chapter from The Overspent America.
The typical middle to upper middle class household occupies more than 2,000 square feet of floor space, owns at least two cars, a couple of couches, numerous chairs, beds and tables, a washer and dryer, more than two televisions, a VCR, and has cable. The kitchen contains a conventional oven, a microwave, a frost-free refrigerator, a blender, a coffee maker, a tea kettle, a food processor, and so many pots, pans, dishes, cups, glasses, storage containers, kitchen utensils, and pieces of flatware that they aren't even counted. Elsewhere in this house are a personal computer and a printer, telephones, an answering machine, a calculator, a stereo or CD player, musical instruments, and many pieces of art. In addition to paintings and reproductions, there are decorative items such as vases, plates, and statuettes, photographs in frames, and knickknacks. In the bathroom are a hairdryer, a scale, perhaps an electric toothbrush or shaver, and cabinets overflowing with towels, shampoos, conditioners, face creams, and other cosmetics. The closets are stuffed with clothes and shoes of all types, dresses, suits, pants, shirts, sweaters, coats, hats, boots, sneakers, flats, pumps, walking shoes, patent leathers, and loafers. And don't forget the jewelry. In addition to watches, the diamond ring, and other high-value items, there's usually a large collection of costume jewelry, bead necklaces, bracelets, and earrings. The family room is filled with books, videos, tapes, CDs, magazines, and more photos and knickknacks. The floors are covered with rugs or carpet, and throughout the house are scattered other pieces of furniture, accented perhaps with dried or silk flowers. Stored in the garage or basement is all the sports equipment, such as bicycles and skis, as well as luggages and totes, lawn and garden tools. In addition to all these durable products, households spend heavily on services such as childcare, movies, restaurants and bars, hotel stays, airplane trips, haircuts, massages, visits to Disney World, lawyer bills, insurance premiums, interest payments, and sometimes rental on the storage space where even more stuff resides. If you are a typical consumer, you did not always have so much. There was probably a time in your adult life when you could fit everything you owned into your car and drive off into the sunset. Now you need professionals to transport your possessions.
If I find something that I really love, I've got to have it. If that's materialistic, yes.
Americans are, in fact, too materialistic.
Is that a joke question? Oh my God, it's disgusting.
We're an extremely materialistic culture.
Now, wait a minute, just a minute. What's wrong with this type of materialism?
Duane Elgin, author of Voluntary Simplicity.
I think many of us in our society, our consumer society, are so distracted, so alienated, so fragmented by the whole consumption process that we are not sure if we've actually been alive.
Cecile Andrews, author of Slow is Beautiful.
Feeling alive in this country has come to be a counterfeit feeling. And that we think that when we buy something, we have an excitement and we think we're feeling alive.
Ellie Jackson Baer, author of Sudden Awakening.
The problem is that the moment doesn't last because it's brought on by particular circumstances. So then you have to shop again or have sex again or do whatever it is that brought on the blissful experience.
I wish my living room were all redone.
In most of human history, having more did make you happier. And that's not true anymore.
On one level, the Industrial Revolution transformed the very nature of work, replacing the slow, deliberate age of craftsmanship with the planned frenzy of the factory.
Machines, inventions, power, black out the past. Forget the quiet cities. Bring in the steam and steel, the iron men, the giants. Open the throttles faster and faster.
But on another level, as the sheer speed and efficiency of the new age exploded into unprecedented levels of productivity, something more fundamental was in the process of being transformed. The very way people saw themselves and their place in the world. In the process, revolutionizing not only how much stuff we were able to produce for others, but how much we would be able to acquire for ourselves.
Right before the century turned, we had the roaring 90s.
Hello, my honey. Hello, my ragtime gal.
My baby.
Send me a kiss by wire.
Which were a period like the 1920s and the 1980s and 90s, which was a period, a lot of wealth being made, a lot of wealth being concentrated at the top. So the distribution got more and more unequal.
James Twitchell, Professor of Advertising and Culture, University of Florida.
So in American culture, the first person that really looked carefully at over-the-top consumption was this wonderful, curmudgeon, cantankerous character named Thorsten Veblen.
Thorsten Veblen wrote his classic theory of the leisure class, and that was a partly satirical but very serious look at the growing role of using products to convey social status and to create social superiority. You know, obviously took a dislike to ostentation and wealth, saw it as a violation of the type of values that he thought the country should be expressing.
And for the first time, he really laid out the importance of consumption as a way of defining self, that you would consume, as he said, conspicuously, because you wanted somebody else to see exactly who you were. American culture does, after World War II, take a profound shift.
I wish I had a castle in the sky where we could watch the world go by with silver from the moonlight and gold from the sun in our own, just our own, wishing castle in the sky.
As people who had always yearned to be part of the consumerist mentality were allowed in. And they were allowed in both because they had the disposable time and the disposable money. And also because the suppliers of objects, cars, refrigerators, all kinds of things that had been difficult to get to, now were streaming this stuff at ever cheaper prices into a eager community of consumers.
Hurry, 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 hurry. The world is so full of a number of things, and we don't want to miss any.
And so you had more and more people from the working class being incorporated into a middle-class lifestyle, being able to own homes, move to the suburbs, and so forth. The idea of keeping up with the Joneses arises in that context, and the idea is that the Joneses live, you know, in the house next door in the subdivision, and you're watching them as they accumulate Chevy, washing machine, television. Keeping up with the Joneses means trying to keep up with a rising standard of living, looking at people you know, people you live among, so it's a neighborhood-based model. I think the other important part about that model, in contrast to today, is that it was a model of face-to-face social interaction. People wanted things not because the advertisers told them they needed to have them, but because their neighbor had it, and they saw the Chevy drive into the driveway. People saw the new clothing or the stuff for the kids or whatever it was, and they saw it and wanted it, and it was really a model of social comparison. In the 70s, you start to see things changing. A couple of big changes. One is the number of women going into the workforce, working for pay, increases, particularly among married women, married with children. They shift out of that more egalitarian neighborhood context into corporations, which are very hierarchical. And so they're exposed to people of higher economic levels, their boss, their boss's boss, and so forth. And then the other key thing is that instead of a situation in which people all up and down the economic distribution are pretty much just looking to others who are like them, more and more people start to gaze toward the top, the so-called affluent lifestyle. Now, that happens for a couple of reasons. One is that those people are becoming very conspicuous in the way they're consuming. They're getting into the newspapers and the magazines. Some of the most famous examples of this start in the 1980s, Dallas and Dynasty. Soap operas, which had always overrepresented the wealthy, come into prime time and are seen by many, many more people. This is the era where you have the show, The Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, which eventually, you know, morphs into MTV's Cribs and then Home and Garden TV. And as people watch more and more media, they're no longer seeing what's happening with their neighbors because they're increasingly don't even know their neighbors. Or new kinds of houses got built where people drive right into the house when they come home and they don't have to go outside. So the decline of social interaction at the neighborhood level becomes very important. And it's a process like what Veblen was talking about in the 1890s. Really, really conspicuous consumption.
Enter the age of modern advertising. Consumption may have been conspicuous, but appeals to our consumer desires would become even more so, giving rise to a glistening new world of images and messages and brands. A world of surface appeals targeted at deep human needs by a new class of experts charged with awakening our inner urge to shop.
Rod Gorney, Executive Director, Ashley Montague Institute.
For those of us who have enough, we are no longer stimulated by our cravings and our scarcity to consume more. So now, in order to make us consume more, we are subjected to a lot of propaganda.
Oh my God, everything is advertising.
We're being run by our subconscious drives. And as long as we're being run by our subconscious drives, then those who are conscious of those drives can manipulate them and control them. And so then it's really just lining up the barnyard animals, and farmers find if you play soothing music, the cows give better milk. So you get mall music everywhere.
We have opened our doors to the devil.
Chris Jordan, graphic artist.
The machine of advertising and marketing that has just become phenomenally sophisticated over the last 40 or 50 years is in very large part running the whole consumer culture.
On every billboard, radio and television, on every newspaper and magazine.
And it's frightening because they've gotten so good at reaching in and finding what motivates, you know, the macho man or the even beautiful woman but who wants to be more beautiful or the uncomfortable teenager. Like, they know how to go straight to our fears.
Ladies and gentlemen, this commercial is going to use subliminal advertising.
In a very strange way, I think our society is being subjected to a kind of mind control.
That means you will never see or hear the name of the product.
It's very much to me like the movie The Matrix.
Sales, they've got to go up.
We have to step back out of the Matrix and learn how to make choices for ourselves.
You're powerless.
I'll show you how powerless I am. My brain burns with it.
They've switched. It used to be, you know, if you buy this, then you'll be popular. And now it's buy this and you will be happy.
Make your holiday wishes come true.
They're very, very clever, and no, I think it's a particularly towards kids.
Duane Elgin, author of Voluntary Simplicity.
I think it's enormously unfair to take some of the best trained minds in cognitive psychology, to take some of the best trained technicians working with computer animations and graphics, put those together into short segments of 30 seconds or so that tell people, well, here's who you are and here's what's important.
Let's not forget the young people.
In my last book, Born to Buy, I did a survey of kids. This is a group. The market is called tweens. They're marketed to very, very intensely. What my survey found is that Involvement in consumer culture undermines kids' well-being in a variety of ways that the kids who are less exposed, those kids are better off. They're healthier. They have a better sense of self.
Give those kids something for their busy little minds, I always say.
I used a statistical model that allows us to ask the question, is it poor parenting that leads to consumer involvement? But what's interesting today is that the good parents and the bad parents have super consumer involved kids.
We're spending 20 times as much to target kids with advertising today as we were in 1980. This is paying off. And the tactics, which include trying to make parents look like idiots and fuddy-duddies, this sort of stuff to promote aggressive and rude behavior because it's cool and will sell a product. I've heard marketers say antisocial behavior
in pursuit of a product is a good thing.
Sweden doesn't allow advertising to kids under 12. Neither does the province of Quebec, and neither should we.
Carol Holst, director of Post Consumers.
If your children are growing up in a culture in which what everybody is doing is involving themselves in consumer culture, it's very difficult to isolate them from that.
I think Madison Avenue has an enormous amount of power in our lives. It's been said that to control a society, you don't need to control its courts, you don't need to control its armies. All you need to do is control its stories. And it's television and Madison Avenue that's telling us most of the stories, most of the time, to most of the people.
It's interesting, I think a number of folks, myself included, get to a certain point where it's really invisible. And I think, in a sense, because it's so all-pervasive, the advertisers have created that scenario themselves. You know, they've bombarded us with messages to the point where we just don't listen anymore and honestly don't care. So I don't really have the anger around it, but I know some people do.
Because it's subliminal, right?
Subliminal.
You're like walking around and there's all sorts of posters and banners and stuff that you don't even recognize, you don't even see.
We just bought a car, and I believe that the advertising was a big part of that.
I've got some big news.
The average person sees about 25,000 commercials on television a year, and every commercial is not simply a pitch for a product, it's a pitch for a set of values, an attitude towards life.
If you realize that the human being is hardwired to respond emotionally to stories, you can now understand why applying stories to things is so important. So if you have a widget that comes out of a widget machine, and here's another widget from another widget machine, if I can tell you a story about this one that separates this one from that one, I can actually get you to feel differently. And feeling is what we're after. Very often luxury objects are objects that are only separated because of the way they're able to make us feel, oh, now I've got it. Got what? Got overpriced water? Got an overpriced car? You put the logic machine on top of it, it makes no sense. But you put the emotional machine next to it, you can see what's happening.
Human beings are very unusual in that they have a large enough brain and a capacity to be able to see beyond the immediate instinctual striving, which is what drives most animals. The part of the brain that grew is our frontal lobes, which are the intelligent, rational part of the brain. So on the one hand, we're instinctually driven, but on the other side, we have this incredible intelligence, which allows us to either harness the instinctual stuff or to be harnessed by it. From a neuroscience standpoint, this is predicated upon the very well worked out and understood process by which the brain pays attention to the environment, and it's called the reward system, and it's driven by a set of chemistries which are called the dopamine chemistries. There are many ways in which this reward system can be hijacked. The most obvious are things like cocaine, amphetamines, caffeine.
I like coffee.
But those systems, once they are hijacked, they essentially take over all the rational part of thinking. I mean, they're very valuable in keeping us safe and telling us what's good and bad in the world, but the danger is that they get caught up in a reward cycle which is meaningless. I like ice cream. I like potato chips. But I know that if I were to eat ice cream and potato chips all day long, I would probably turn out to be weighing 250 pounds, which probably would not be good for me. It used to be restricted because there was no ice cream and there were no potato chips. But now, in our affluent society, we have all these things. We have to consciously say to ourselves, how much of this do I need? You know, more of this is not enough. You need something beyond ice cream and chips. So it's complicated, but it's not difficult to understand. It's a balance between rational behavior and instinctual behavior. The instinctual behavior is what drives the reward system, and the rational behavior is what makes you human.
Juliet Shaw, professor of sociology from Boston College.
Let's just think about the context in which we're living.
We are continuously looking for new things.
So that the consumer marketplace never stays still. And in fact, things are accelerating.
So everybody wants a new cell phone, even though the old one's working perfectly. You want one with a flip-up top, or the one that's silver or red, or, you know, has more buttons on it.
Everything has to be stainless steel. I can't live without anything stainless steel.
And I got all kinds of play toys.
I like to walk through big super centers just as like a test of will, you know? I'll go down and I'll just be like, oh, that looks delicious. No.
Coffee maker, espresso machine.
And I got a Bentley and a latte and it's red.
My one thing is I like Coach purses.
Perfume. Can't have sexy clothes without perfume. Jewelry.
But it?
Okay, that would be fine in some ways if it were sustainable in a financial sense or in an ecological sense, because the system is always moving. Your identity with any one set of products is always changing. But the basic rationale behind wanting the stuff is very fundamentally rooted in deep social dynamics around inequality, competition, social esteem, and so forth. Because our system says that you gain esteem through what you have and how you show it. Consumption is about social communication and social connection. The problem isn't that consumption is social. That's a good thing. The problem is that we are socially communicating, connecting in very perverse and dysfunctional ways.
The rise of consumer society has long raised serious concerns about declines in democratic participation and citizenship. Whatever the virtues of consumption, they have not always sat well with the basic demand in democratic societies for people who know what's going on in the world and aren't afraid to participate in it.
John Dewey, on his 90th birthday, said, "Democracy is born in conversation, and it's talking to each other about it and getting a chance to think. If we have this lifestyle that has no time, that's filled up with advertising all the time, or working long hours, or driving in your car, you know, we have to run around to do things. We can't walk, we can't ride a bike."
The barriers that have now allowed us to essentially work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, they've been removed. You know, the time is no longer an issue, space is no longer an issue, distance is no longer an issue. We can just work all the time. What you find is that there's a rising level of anxiety in the country because everybody's continuously competing, worrying that somehow somebody's going to get ahead of them.
With that shift to that vertical emulation process, where now everybody wants to live like the upper middle class and the wealthy, that's happening at a time when people's actual ability to do that financially is eroding. As wages have stagnated, as families have to add another earner to the labor force in order just to keep up, what do? Well, they borrow more, they work more hours, they run down their savings.
All that makes people very anxious because they're constantly on their toes. The human body wasn't designed for that. The human body was designed for acute emergencies. But when the acute emergency is continuous, when the alarm bells are ringing all the time, it never relaxes. And the results of that are people get all sorts of stress diseases. Anxiety is just the beginning. Depression, they get depression because they feel they can't cope. They get other somatic diseases like hypertension, cardiovascular disease. So one of the most obvious results of this fast-paced world is that we tend to reduce the time we spend in social interaction around very important functions, such as eating, for example. And we spend much less time now eating around a table than we do driving around in a car together.
Hey, Mom! Look, I don't want to hear another word out of you. Bobby, Billy, Betty, what the hell's the kid's name?
John DeGraff, National Coordinator of Take Back Your Time.
In our families, even our pets are affected by this. You know, not too long ago, there was a story in a Marin County newspaper that said that the fastest growing business in Marin was professional dog walkers. Even a dog's life isn't what it used to be.
I think Lily Tomlin described it well when she said the problem with the rat race is that even if you win, you're still a rat. And people are feeling themselves as a part of that busyness, and they want to declutter their lives. They want to simplify their lives so they have more time for that which really matters.
Cecile Andrews, author of Slow is Beautiful.
You know, I ask people when I go and speak to people at workplaces, and I say, you know, do you feel some hope? Can you do something about your lack of time? And they say, no. And I always think, how can this have happened? The most powerful country in the world, and its people feel powerless to change?
Peter Wybrow, author of American Mania.
So the affluence drives us into sickness because we can't figure out what to do with it. We haven't spent enough time thinking about it. We've spent a lot of time thinking about how to survive when there isn't much around to eat or when it's dangerous, etc., etc., but we haven't spent any time thinking about what to do with affluence.
How did we get into this problem that we're faced with now, where life is becoming more and more complicated and where we are urgently in need of greater simplicity?
Well, that sounds like a leading question, but let's have it.
The first cell and all of the species in between that first cell and ourselves were guided by a basic principle, which you could call the basic law of life, cooperation.
Where's all this competition we've heard so much about?
Competition was always a part of that evolution, but everywhere and always, competition was subordinate until relatively recently. 3 million years ago, our earliest human relatives began to evolve on this planet. They survived mainly by taking care of each other. And they took care of each other not because they were saints, but because they were each other's only social security. Whether or not we admit this today, we survive as a species mainly because we are still the virtuoso caretakers of one another.
And maybe that's the biggest way you feel alive, is when you help each other. And you don't do that in a consumer society.
Julian Darley, Executive Director of the Post Garvan Institute.
A lot of the root of our consumption and a lot of the root of many of our other problems, psychological problems and so forth, emotional problems which we see all around us, those can be found in our tendency towards individualism. Once you start thinking of yourself as an individual, an awful lot of the glue that keeps us together, makes us feel part of something, starts to dissolve. It's worth pointing out that large quantities of money and energy drive that dissolution quicker than almost anything else. Because what happens is it gives you the ability to separate yourself from others.
Whatever level of community we had from the 1940s and 50s has been destroyed. Television has been a big part of that.
The old social structures are falling away, but they're essential to human learning. They're the sort of immune system, the crucible of the next generation. And we're not spending any time thinking about how we replace them.
Once you're an individual, that stresses this idea of being separated kind of an entity. So that means you need a separate house, a separate car, separate cooking facilities, washing machine, dishwasher, fridge or fridges, bathing, cleaning, everything you can imagine.
We're a victim of our myth.
That myth that the road to the good life is the goods life, that the good economy is the economy that always grows more and 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 more. And we need to ask the question, first and foremost, what is an economy for? If an economy is just for being number one and having the grossest domestic product, at the expense of our health, our communities, our families, our environment, then that economy in 250 will buy me a short latte. We have got to ask the question, why are we so obsessed with producing and consuming stuff at the expense of every other value we claim to believe in?
Let me suggest that the economy is not the flow of money, as would be popularly believed. It's actually the flow of energy and the flow of resources that goes along with that. So this system of economics, which we developed, you could find a lot of words to describe it. Crazy, devastating, and I'm afraid, ultimately suicidal.
Beneath the surface spectacle of an apparently endless parade of goods and commodities lies a decidedly less infinite truth, that the cheap energy that modern industrial societies have been relying on for more than a century may not be able to keep pace with the sheer force of global economic growth.
Economist Alan Greenspan talks on the war on Iraq.
I'm saying it is about oil and that I believe it was necessary to get Saddam out of it.
Oil was at first a replacement for whale oil, a species which, particularly the Atlantic whale, was being driven to extinction at a great rate of knots. In the early 1900s, in fact 1901, a great gusher was discovered in Texas called Spindletop. And that is what really began to change the quantities of oil that were flowing. So when you have the idea of the automobile, which was coming on stream in a big way after 1900, there were traffic jams by 1910 and so forth in the US, that really kind of sealed the fate of the world, along with the many technological inventions that went along with it. And what it allowed us to do was transform transport. That's an obvious one, is that it allows us to go vast distances. And that's partly because of the enormous energy contained in a liter, a gallon, a pint, a barrel of oil. It's just absolutely stunning, the amount that's in there. It's equivalent to a month's work of a very strong man is contained in, say, a gallon of gasoline. It's no wonder that we can do so much of it. Once we got hold of this virtually unlimited, very cheap flowing energy source, we unlocked its potential to extraordinary and, I think, frankly, disastrous results. It's totally transformed the planet. It's allowed an enormous population explosion. It's allowed us to flow into every nook and cranny of the planet and transform that, and that's putting it nicely. There are many, many other things that we've done with oil. It's also transformed the way we do food.
Essentially, we're eating fossil fuels.
Industrial agriculture, in the words of Al Bartlett, is the use of land to turn oil and gas into food. And that's really worth bearing in mind, how much of our food depends on oil and gas. But then there's everything else. There's the varnishes and the paints and the plastics and the process heat used for metals and glass and silicon PV panels. And it's just absolutely endless. And it's worth pointing out that there's a fundamental difference between coal and trees and other things, which every pound or every unit of energy that you want to get from coal or from trees or peat, you have to cut it down or dig it up. You have to move that number of molecules yourself. You have to put some effort into it, whereas with oil and gas, they flow. And in the early stages, they literally flow out under vast pressure on their own. As that flow goes into decline, and it looks like it has begun to decline, we will find that there's an enormous difference between flowing energy and energy that you have to mine or melt or hack or process.
David Room, founder of Energy Preparedness.
When we're talking about global oil peak, we are specifically talking about supply. So demand is a whole different thing, and therein lies the problem, because if we look at how industrial civilization has grown, and we can see that it scales up with the advent of oil and natural gas. And so as we see the production of oil increase, we're also seeing the amount of GNP, we're seeing the population, we're seeing everything else scale up as well. We'll be right back.
What do we do with the immutable, inescapable fact that to get to this level, we are ravaging and pillaging the earth? It's an inconvenient truth, but it's a truth.
If we look at resources, right now we're consuming about 1.2 Earths. And if everyone on this planet were to consume and live roughly at the level that we do in the United States, it would take 5 Earths.
And all you have to do is stroll around the world and see when people have a chance to get to this other world, how eagerly they do it.
And we're very rapidly moving in that direction.
Across the continent, the white men rolled, first on wheels of wood, then on wheels of steel, hacking, ripping, and gouging as they went, building a great and mighty nation, and rearing their fabulous cities where once the teepees stood.
Now our technologies are so powerful, our impact upon the world is so great, that we're actually undoing the ecological foundations on which our future depends.
Finding ways to meet such big challenges will obviously require big thinking by a lot of people. But the possibility of such a focused movement rising up to solve these problems will remain remote if people are unable or unwilling to recognize that there even is a problem in the first place.
When you look around, it doesn't look like there's anything wrong.
Actually, I call it the sunny day syndrome. You look outside and you see a beautiful sunny day.
Water flows out of the tap nice and cleanly. There are plenty of mountains to go hiking in.
There's no blackouts.
The food at the supermarket is healthy and fairly uncontaminated.
Really hard for people to comprehend that there's actually a problem.
We can see a certain number of miles on a clear day, but basically we use our eyes to look at the world from a few feet to a few yards or meters away. Where anywhere in evolution would any creature, including us, have had access to the means to be able to think about what would happen in 10 years or 10,000 miles away? We couldn't possibly think about that. I mean, we didn't understand weather at all well. We didn't understand the stars. All we could do was observe, and that's what our brains are designed to deal with.
Currently, about 25% of all plant and animal species on the Earth are threatened with extinction.
We've been through 5 world extinctions, according to our scientists. Most of them are brought on by cataclysmic events out of the control of Earth. From being hit by asteroids to, you know, volcanic explosions. Different things have wiped us out, wiped out all the species. We're now in the first major extinction that was caused by one of the species. We're in the middle of an extinction that is faster than the dinosaurs died off. We've caused it.
Species, extincting them, has been compared to flying along in an airplane and popping rivets. And you may decide, well, a few rivets come out here, a few rivets come out there. But after a while, the whole plane flies apart. And that's what we're doing to the biosphere. We're unraveling the very fabric, the web of life itself is coming unraveled.
Perhaps that releases a genetic signal that what was once so successful, which is the ego was the brilliant survival machine. It brought us dominance of the earth, but now it's killing us. And perhaps now, as the ego went from being a huge medicine for survival to a huge poison of destruction, it sets off the next biochemical signal that it's time to wake up, it's time to evolve to the next level. And the shock to wake up is we're killing our own earth. That kind of shock can wake up the whole of humanity.
This is something for people who study the other side of materialism, namely the wasted side, the garbage side, the destruction side.
Chris Jordan, graphic artist, describes his large image of enormous mounds of waste, quite beautiful, but of course haunting in its significance.
This is one of the first images that I made in this body of work. One of the things that that I found really interesting when I made the large print of this image was people would come over to my house and, you know, we'd stand in front and look, and people would start pointing out things that they use. And I noticed the same thing. My wife and I would stand here and look and go, oh my gosh, look, Campbell's soup. Or Bush's country-style baked beans. We just had those a couple nights ago. And one of the things that hit me is the fact that this isn't somebody else's garbage. And in fact, that can of Bush's country-style baked beans might be the very can that we used.
It's interesting and frightening to think about the concept that each of our own individual consumptive practice is so small in the grand scale that it doesn't matter. What the heck is one more SUV when they sold 3.6 million of them in the United States last year? And any one person can justify all of their consumptive practices based on that. And yet, it's also true that the aggregate combined effect of all of our consumptive behavior is totally trashing the earth. You can stand back from it and look at huge sort of aggregate numbers like the amount of oil we use or the amount of global warming that's happening. Or you can, sort of like a satellite photograph, you can zoom further and further and further in and just look at one product among the thousands of products that we use, like cell phones. And if you just look at the environmental footprint of cell phones and all the things that go into them, the amount of waste in cell phones, just that is staggeringly enormous and complex. And then you zoom back a little bit further and you realize there are all of these products that those kind of figures apply to. And then you zoom back even further and think about the infrastructure of our consumerism, like all the trucks that are on the road, all the trains that are carrying stuff and the planes that are flying back and forth and the oil fields that are sucking the oil out of the ground. And if you get all the way back, you can't see the details anymore.
One of the things I refer to when I talk about my work is this observation that the apocalypse is in progress. You know, when I walk around and look at these vast piles of garbage that I find, it looks to me like apocalyptic. The concept of the apocalypse is something that's supposed to happen fast and spectacularly and dramatically, but it seems to me that it's possible that the apocalypse is actually happening, and it's us that is making it happen, and it's just increment by increment by increment.
What we are doing to our planet and to our individual spirits is something that I think can kill the joy and like all the reasons that people want to be alive.
Is the issue is so huge and the scale is so staggering and American behavior is just so phenomenally out of bounds in so many ways that it's impossible to even comprehend. Being unable to comprehend it is an easy way to justify keeping right on going the way we are.
I think if you ask almost anybody, are you living a life doing what you know is the right thing? I think the vast majority of people, if they looked hard at it, they'd have to admit they aren't. But somehow the cost to them of knowing that they're doing something that is not okay with them, they can bear that. It's worth it to have a bitchin' car, and it's worth it to have a really nice new set of rosewood speaker cabinets. And so we all walk around with this little bit of a bad feeling without knowing what it would be like to live a life where you don't have that bad feeling, where your conscience is in here with you.
With matters of conscience come matters of fact and responsibility. And it's a fact now too obvious to ignore that what we're doing to maintain our lifestyles here is bound to have repercussions elsewhere. Not everyone benefits equally from what the system offers, and not everyone pays the same price, creating the potential for conflict and backlash.
I think the biggest threat we face as a species is the gap between how urgent it is that we learn to change our values and to predominantly take care of each other, and the enormous rage and revenge that people around the world are seeking for the fact that they are mostly exploited.
Violence is going to increase because more people are going to have less. So basically right now, everybody better get what they can in order to set up some sort of stable future for their offspring.
That brings me to another warning to humanity, and this came from 100 Nobel Prize winners. And they said, quote, "The most profound danger to world peace in coming years will not stem from the irrational acts of states or individuals, but from the legitimate demands of the world's dispossessed."
Once you corral all the resources, it necessarily weakens those other people over there, and it means you can dominate them and control them and thus bring ever more resources your way. And we have many techniques of doing this, including the modern methods of trade, which to me at many times look like very little other than a clever legalized form of piracy. We've drawn up the rules and said this is an okay way of doing it. So all of this is basically comes down to the fact if you concentrate resources in one place and take them from another place, that increases polarization. That means that some people are doing without and other people are doing with very much. And there you have at least one of the roots of a fairly profound form of economic injustice.
It really is going to take a humbling of our psyche as Americans to realize the horror that has been done with our dollars and in our name so that we could buy cheap stuff.
We live in a living system, and as a biological living organism itself, there's going to be forever, I think, a tension between how resources are allocated. So the first step towards our maturity as a human family is to recognize this tension and this requirement to consciously learn how to live sustainably on the earth. The situation is so complex that no government, I feel, can figure it out and come up with a plan in time to solve our situation. And so it's going to require self-directing individuals at the local scale to take charge of their lives and pull their lives back from these parental institutions of business and government and say, I'm going to handle this myself.
If you ask the question of responsibility, it almost immediately plugs you right back into the wider problematic, if you like, which for some people might be daunting, but I hope that it could also be seen as rather exciting. And we've got these quite powerful brains. They're quite good at doing these kinds of tasks, but we have to practice doing it.
I remember seeing a photograph of an ocean liner during the war against the Nazis, which had been torpedoed and was sinking. And people were asked to come down the gangplank into the water where lifeboats were waiting to pick them up. And I saw a couple of guys, and I was told that these were immigrants who had hoped to come to the New World carrying two suitcases each, stuffed with jewelry and watches, which was the way they hoped they could fund the beginning of their new life. And they walked down the gangplank, right into the water, and went to the bottom. In many respects, that is what is happening to us today.
It's incumbent upon all of us, I think, to take that look in the mirror to see what we're doing with our own unique lives and to look at the food that we eat, the clothes that we wear, the car that we drive, the home in which we live, the work that we do, and so on, and make choices that will collectively move us towards a more sustainable, compassionate, and wonderful future.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving.